Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Tannert, for the report from the General Conference of Elders. I thought that was very helpful in putting it together. Appreciate that very much. Thanks for working through the technical glitches there, Mr. Anderson. You did get the gist of everything. We were able to get everything down in Sierra Vista, and you may have missed 20, 30 seconds, something like that, but I think you got the gist of it, and I thought that was very encouraging as a camp video. Revelation 12 is a fascinating chapter of Bible prophecy. It begins with very unusual language, and I'll have to admit that I actually skipped over the first verse for many years, had not really understood the complexity of this particular passage, in fact, the entire chapter. But that language is both mysterious and has so much to do with life and with our lives, with the Church of God, and many, many other things. I don't know about you, but for me, the first time I ever read about Revelation 12 was when in 1971, in the summer, I think it was probably August, I was getting interested in the church then. My brother had given me the booklet, The Book of Revelation Unveiled at Last. And in that booklet, as you'll remember, Mr. Armstrong outlined each of the chapters, and he described very accurately that chapter 12 was an inset chapter about the Church of God. And that's true, and that is correct. But it contains that, and it's primarily what he labeled as an inset chapter that's set within the chronological story flow, but also in a very subtle way. It contains a key to Bible prophecy that many people simply don't have. Now, I know that you believe that you are in the Church of God, but are the events of this chapter real to you? Do they specifically apply to you? Have you ever wondered about that? Do you see yourself? Do you see the church in this chapter of Bible prophecy? I hope that you do. What about your friends in the church? What is going to happen to you, your family, and your friends in the future? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever wondered about your future in the Church of God? When I was coming into the church in 1971 and studying that booklet, among other booklets, the Church of God, the worldwide Church of God, had a corner on prophecy. Very few people talked about Bible prophecy in any church at all. There was very little mention of prophecy. I told you the story before about how Billy Graham, in a telephone call set up by Harrods of London, had called him and thanked Mr. Armstrong for his gift of prophecy. And I remember coming into the church, listening to these 50,000-watt stations and hearing Mr. Armstrong preach and hearing his son preach and talk about prophecy. And many of you did as well. We have many people that listen to those programs. But we don't have a corner on prophecy any longer. Let me put it this way. We're not the only ones that are interested in Bible prophecy. Just for an aside, I asked Marty down in Sierra Vista, who's got a computer that she can look at all the time. I said, you know, just for interest's sake, type in the terms into Google, and let's do a Google search, and just type in the two words, Bible prophecy. And she, you know, instantaneously it comes back. There are over 13 million hits. Now, that doesn't mean there's 13 million places on the internet that you can go to find sources about Bible prophecy, but it's far greater than probably most people would imagine. There's just realms of information out there. Those of you who have computers or mobile devices, if you wish, you can use that to access the internet. You'll find a lot of information about the Bible and about Bible prophecy, far more interest, far more than I think we ever had back in 1971 when I knew that I was the only one in my town. It was a small town, granted, but I was the only one in my town who was in the Church of God. Eventually, I became baptized a year or so later, but I was the only one there and for many miles around. I was the only one in my little part of Western Maryland, except for my brother, and later on my sister came into the church. But just by way of showing you that there is something that is contained within this chapter that sets you apart, not only because you're in the church of God, but it sets you apart from the standpoint that you understand this hidden key of Bible prophecy that very few people understand. And I don't know how many people will ever tumble onto it. But there are thousands of years of history and prophecy compressed within this chapter. And these 17 verses contain information that show the lives of God's people are going to be dramatically affected in the years ahead, as you know. Excuse me just a second, I'll pull the carpet out from under myself. It was a little bit too close to the, I think it was when we moved the lectern, we've got a carpet that makes things soft, and I was on the very edge of the back of it and rocking on my heels, so I didn't like that. If you're a good journalist, and there's not many of those these days, but if you're a good journalist and you're hooked by the intrigue and the mysterious nature of this passage, automatically what leaps into your mind are the questions of who, what, when, where, and how. All of those things are important to somebody that has an inquisitive mind. As a member of the Church of God, in reading these events, you may want to know how you can be included in one group and how maybe, hopefully, you'd like to be excluded from another group, both of them, the Church of God. That's not your primary concern, and I'll try to explain that a little bit later. In other words, how do I go to the place of safety is not your primary concern. If I can just spell it out, I can just get it out there for you. Let's begin in verse 1. We'll skip around to other parts in the Bible, but I'll admit that aspects of this I hadn't really thought of. There's some passages of the Bible that sometimes we read over. I did. I'm guilty. I'm charging myself. And I'd read over this first verse without really contemplating it for many, many years. Now a great sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. This first verse contains a key, or it helps you to understand a key when you understand its implications that have eluded many Bible students. It also reveals the subject matter not only is pertinent to the true Church of God, but it has national interests as well. It helps us to understand not just the Church of God, but also, in addition to that spiritual application, a national application. The only other place that language of this type is mentioned in the Bible is found in Genesis 37. So let's go to Genesis 37. Hold your place there in the book of Revelation if you need to. We'll go to Genesis 37, which gives us a great clue as to whom God has placed importance on, who he chooses to do his will, and it's possible that, like me, I'm not ascribing my ignorance to everybody else, I'm just saying it's possible that you may have overlooked this particular point. So you know that Genesis 37, this particular part has to do with Jacob. So Genesis 37, and it has to do with Jacob's sons. In verse 1, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. Now this, to me, is fascinating. We open up talking about Jacob. You know that Jacob was later named, chapters back, he was named Israel because he wrestled with God and he overcame. He was an overcomer of sin. He overcame his nature, which was supplanter. Jacob means supplanter, and God named him Israel, which means overcomer. And so we know that from previous chapters. This individual is one of the most important figures in all of the Bible. But notice, this struck me as, I mean, again, something that totally had escaped. It begins by announcing a reflection or a history of Jacob in verse 2. And what does it say immediately afterwards? Joseph. It's a history of Jacob, but Joseph is the next word in the next sentence. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. Automatically, it sets up another very important individual in Bible prophecy and Bible history, his son. Not his firstborn son, Reuben, not the secondborn, which I think was Simeon, without going back to check, but Joseph. Benjamin, I think, was the youngest, the last born, the youngest brother of Joseph. But Joseph is the first one mentioned regarding the history of Jacob. And he was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of sons of Bilpah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, we don't know what that bad report contained, but it's obvious that as you read through this particular chapter, it's obvious that Joseph kind of got the rap, maybe accurately got the rap of being a tattletale on his brothers. That's very obvious. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. And he also made him a tunic of many colors. There was a Broadway play years ago, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor, Raincoat or something. I don't know if that was the name of the play and everything, but it was a very famous Broadway musical, and it had kind of a flavor of the biblical story. And when I was a kid in the 1950s, and I was going to Sunday school, oh horrors, I was going to Sunday school, we would have Bible stories, and we'd have little full-color little leaflets that they'd hand out in Bible class for Bible school before the church service would begin. We'd go to Sunday school. And they had, you know, they'd have Bible lessons. They did teach a little bit from the Bible. And one of them that I remember was on the story of Joseph and the picture of this flowing robe that he was wearing. And it had basically colorful stripes on this robe. And I don't know if I'm the only one, but from my youth, that is what I thought of when I thought of this coat of many colors that Joseph was given by his father, Jacob. Am I alone in that? Does anybody else remember pictures like that? A few of you. Most of the rest of you were born in the church, even Jerry back there, probably a second-generation Christian, I'm sure, but no, just kidding. Probably that's not what the coat of many colors was like. Now, most of you know that I'm Scottish. I'm of Scottish descent. My parents were both born in Scotland. I had, I think I've told you some of this story before, that I had an amateur genealogist in the Bricketwood congregation that did some research on my name and everything, and he associated the Levitical tribes and some of the other tribes of Levitical families and some of the other tribes of Israel or of Jacob as, basically what he said was the coat of many colors was probably not some striped ribbony type of affair, but it was probably similar to a Scottish tartan. Now, a couple days ago, I was with a coworker outside of Starbucks on Wilmot and Speedway, and I was visiting. We were doing some business planning, and an older gentleman walked out, and he actually had his shirt was the Buchanan tartan. And I know that if my mother was alive, she'd have been very insulted that somebody was wearing a shirt made of the Buchanan tartan. And it's not necessarily the prettiest tartan, but it does have a lot of colors. It's got more colors than most of the Scottish tartans. And this, I don't know if it's true or not, it's possible that Joseph's coat of many colors was a Buchanan tartan in its ancient form. I don't know. It's just, you may call it speculation, but it's actually, the Buchanan tartan is not a pretty tartan, I'll have to admit. It's the same, that tartan, that that same basic tartan was on the Drew Carey show on his couch, and we've got a blanket that looks like a Buchanan tartan. It has the same colors and patterns and all that sort of thing. There are other tartans that are prettier, but this one does have a lot of colors. And this is, you know, as good a guess as any. It's as good as a, you know, a ribbony striped robe, so I'm going to say that it was probably a tartan of some kind, but we don't know, I guess. I guess we can't be definitive on that. But it showed that he was favored. It was probably very finely made and probably very, very beautiful. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. God allows many things to happen. He allowed family jealousy to brew up. He allowed this whole situation to come up. Now, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Wow. His brother said to him, the meaning not being lost on any one of them, it was rather obvious what the meaning of this dream was. No mystery. "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more. This is the third time they've hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now, we're getting around to this key of Bible prophecy, which you have, and you may not recognize it yet, but you will. Lost on many students of the Bible is that Jacob, name changed Israel, had, as you know, 12 sons. We don't read in the Bible, in other words, and this is something that is still hard to find, even among people who are interested in prophecy. The assumption is, of course, that Judah out of Israel went. Wait a minute, what happened to everybody else? No, only the Jews left Egypt. It was only the Jews that left Egypt, and, you know, that's what happened. And only there's only Judah, there's nothing else about Israel. So that is something that is so plain and easy. It's a simple understanding of Bible prophecy that there is a national identity of Israel, which is exclusive of the Jews. Now, they are a part of that history, but it's exclusive of them. And if you don't understand that key to Bible prophecy, you're really never going to completely understand what the book of Revelation is all about. And unbeknownst to me, and having read over it for such a long time, I had overlooked the fact that this chapter not only is an inset chapter regarding the church, but it has national implications. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I have dreamed another dream." They're all excited and waiting for this one, I'm sure. "And this time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." Exact same language, same symbolism, same imagery as in Revelation 12 and verse 1. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him. But his father kept the matter in mind. His father contemplated it. His father thought about what this must have meant. So the meaning of the dream was not lost on either the brothers or the father. But he pondered it. He thought about it. Now, Joseph was a favored son, as it says. He was born at a later stage of Jacob's life. It appears that Jacob pondered the meaning of this dream, and it probably weighed very, very heavily on his mind. Because, if you'll go back to Genesis 28, we find another dream, a very important dream, a dream about the kingdom of God. In Genesis chapter 28, beginning in verse 12, well, we'll get the context and begin in verse 10. "Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head. And he lay down in that place to sleep." Now, some people call this Jacob's pillow stone. Pillar stone probably is a more accurate representation because for those of you that camp, you're aware that most rocks are harder than your head, right? I mean, if you're out camping in the wilderness, the last thing you want to do is put your head down on a soft, comfy rock. He didn't lay his head down on the rock. But it was there, and he placed it in that place, and, you know, there's something to the notion that maybe this is the one that ended up under the coronation chair in Westminster Abbey, maybe. I don't know if there's any way you can totally prove it. Maybe it's carried to Ireland by Jeremiah's descendants and so on and so forth, and you know all of that. But the main thing is, in verse 12, we find that Jacob has a dream. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven. And there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and God of Isaac. The land in which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now you know that for the past couple of hundred years, the nations of the earth have been blessed by the progeny of Israel. I'm not going through any proof today on that. I mean, but that is so obvious that God has intervened in the life of these descendants. It's just too much to be coincidence. I told you before that I'd watched a series on the presidents of the United States. We've had 44 presidents of the United States since 1700s, obviously. The striking thing to me is that though we have great presidents, we have Mount Rushmore has all the great presidents plus Ronald Reagan, another great one. Many others were kind of fair to middling, maybe some of them really mediocre. The point is, you cannot ascertain America's greatness by pointing to its leadership over the past couple of hundred years. You cannot say that America has been led by great, inspiring leaders for over 200 years. It's just not the case. Some of them were kind of scoundrels. And the, whatever it is, the History Channel or whatever, National Geographic did the story, shows it, lays it out in the bare facts. You know, some of them brought the country almost to ruin financially. Many, many stories there, and I think it's a worthwhile series. But some good, some bad, some mediocre, some forgettable, some that didn't stay in office very long, you know, died very shortly after taking office. What explains history is what God prophesied. Verse 15, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done what I've spoken you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? There is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Jacob pondered the dream of his son Joseph, and it may have been a long time before Jacob had had a striking vision and dream and God speaking to him in that dream. But I believe that the reason that he pondered the dream of Joseph was because he realized that Joseph was tapping in and God was intervening in the life of his younger son in much the same way as his life had been intervened in earlier. So we see that there are many things here in this story of Jacob and Joseph and his brothers that God allows. He allows a family jealousy to emerge, yet he used it to fulfill his will. He didn't intervene at every single point of crisis in Joseph's life to prevent problems from occurring to him, and yet it's obvious that he was there every step of the way, allowing the events to unfold in such a way as that Joseph would be brought into the court of Pharaoh, and this gift that he has of interpreting dreams is now used when God gives dreams to other people, and it brings him to the point eventually of prominence, as we know, where a nation is saved. And I don't mean a nation of Egypt, although you could say that he saved that nation as well. I'm talking about how the nation of Israel, how his brothers were saved. Now, in Genesis chapter 48, the prelude to the blessings chapter being poured out upon the descendants of Jacob, we find a conference of blessings, these birthright blessings that we know all too well. Notice, now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed, your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. But remember that the dream of Joseph, the original dream that made his brothers angry, is implanted into the beginning of Revelation 12. So it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed, your father is sick, and he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, look, your son Joseph is coming to you. And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I'll give you a multitude of people, and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. They're my sons now. It would be ludicrous for me to tell my kids, okay, bring the granddaughters over here, they're mine now. But there is a special purpose for this. And Israel, Jacob, recounts the history of his life. And he says in verse 7, but as for me, let me go back to verse 6. Your offspring, whom you beget after them, shall be yours. They will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel, remember the name, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, who are these? And so we know what happened. This fantastic blessing was conferred upon them. And Joseph thought that Jacob had it wrong, tried to switch the hands over. Ephraim was the youngest. Manasseh was the oldest. Jacob told him, I know just what I'm doing. They're both going to be great, but one is going to be a multitude of nations. We know that. And this is the blessing that he gave to them. God, before verse 15, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. He knew that angelic protection had been with him throughout life. Bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. Let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And so then the switching of the hands, or the attempt at switching the hands, and Jacob did not allow that. Verse 21, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers to Joseph, one portion above his brothers, which are named in the next chapter. All the other brothers who were jealous, angry, vengeful, spiteful, sold him into slavery, there are blessings that are conferred upon all of them, or let's say a projection of what these people would be like in history that would identify them, signs that would identify them. And if we are correct, which I'm not going to go into it now, if we are correct in our research as to whom these various tribes are, it is very obvious that they are a part of Israel. And it is very obvious that they are descendants of Israel in the greater sense. They are the sons of Jacob, that is Israel, but they have not had the stupendous blessings that the United States and British Commonwealth peoples have had. There is absolutely no doubt that these two nations have been a blessing to all nations on the face of the earth and have protected people from untold harm that would have come to them had they not been around from the 1800s on. You know the history. You know all of that. Revelation 12 includes Israel and specifically the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh in its prophecy, which, again, is something I'm not bragging about, but it had kind of eluded me in the past. Genesis 49 describes national blessings and national identities. Reuben, we think France. Judah, scattered, we know that. Simeon, Levi, also scattered. Dan, there's some disagreement over Dan. Is it Ireland? Is it Denmark? Gad, pretty sure that describes Switzerland. Reuben, France. Zebulun, the Netherlands. What else do we have here? Where else? Issachar. Issachar, I'm thinking... Finland, yeah, Finland, yes, exactly. Lying down between two burdens, Russia perhaps being one of them. So who have I left out here? Naphtali, Gad, I said Gad, Switzerland, Reuben, Asher, we're thinking Belgium. So that's not the most important aspect, Benjamin, Norway. Okay, I think I've covered them, most of them. If I've left any out, you know what they are. And I said I wasn't going to do it. All right, describes these nations. It's possible we could be wrong or that what we have written in the past, it's possible that you could be off here, there. There may be some argument about Dan. But there can be no argument that the greatest of blessings are here given to Joseph. In verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. His archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above and blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and the crown of the head of him who is separate from his brothers. Incredible blessings of national consequence. Revelation 12, then, takes us back, and we'll go to verse 2 now that we've covered the background of verse 1, which is describing Israel. If you don't have the understanding of the identity of Israel, you'll never fully understand or comprehend Revelation 12 because it includes nations and all the millions of people that live within those nations. Revelation 12 and verse 2. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. This woman in Revelation 12 and verse 2 symbolizes the people of God chosen to be the light of the world, in contrast with the woman of Revelation 17, who is the mother of harlots. The imagery here recalls the ancient history of Israel, and the woman in Revelation 12 is clothed with those same symbols that we find in Joseph's dream, and they also represent then Jacob's family after it expanded into a nation. So it includes both spiritual and physical Israel. It's easy to prove spiritual Israel from the pages of the Bible. Then Revelation 12 takes a step back to the birth of Jesus, to show that the Messiah and God's chosen people are the main focus of the wrath of the devil, which is the other part of this chapter. Then it moves us past that, just as a overview, moves us past that to the time of Christ's second coming. Satan's warfare against the people of God, including Jesus Christ, and the natural descendants of ancient Israel and all true Christians is the primary subject of Revelation 12 and Revelation 13. These chapters explain the devil's motivation and introduce worldly powers that he has used and he will use in an attempt to destroy God's offspring, both physical and spiritual. In verse 3, it says, "Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great and fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads." Diadems is crowns. The imagery here clearly shows, as we see in the next chapter, that the kingdoms of this world, that is, the world-ruling kingdoms that are described in the book of Daniel and Revelation, are motivated in the same way. You see the exact same image of those worldly powers, because in Revelation 13, as you know, you see exactly the same thing in terms of the human governments that are enumerated both by Daniel and by John in Revelation 13. They are clearly the embodiment, the beast powers that have existed, the Babylonian, the Persian, Greco-Macedonian, and Roman empires are described here as the agents of the devil. And who does he use them against? The people of God, in the broader national sense and in the spiritual sense as well, with the church of God. The kingdoms of this world, those world-ruling kingdoms that are described in both Daniel and Revelation, are the devil's opportunity to influence the world. We are introduced in Revelation 13. Sorry, I hadn't changed places myself yet. I'd ask you to. We see exactly the same imagery, and it cannot be mistaken. I mean, it's in the very next chapter. "I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns." Okay? Verse 3 of chapter 12, "Another sign appeared in heaven, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his head." It's the same influence. You have one that is attacking the spiritual entity of the offspring of God, the church, and one that is intent on attacking the people of God who are the descendants of Jacob or Israel and Joseph. Verse 4, "His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who is ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born." Analogies are used in the Bible to explain the spiritual implications. Analogies eventually play out. They break down, as you know. This is in reference to Matthew 2. I have 3 in the notes. It's Matthew 2. If you'll turn to Matthew chapter 2 and hold your place there, this is obviously the reference to what the devil was trying to do at the time, several years after the birth of Jesus Christ. "The wise men," in verse 12, "were divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod." You know the story. "Now when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, 'Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy them.'" We know the Bible prophecy was fulfilled in that Christ's parents took him to Egypt to escape the slaughter that would happen shortly afterwards, because Herod did not want to have a king born in his kingdom that would overtake him. He died shortly after giving this edict, as we understand. But in verse 16, it says, "Then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men," and by the way, some folks think, and I think they're probably correct, that these wise men were from Israel. They were from the people of Israel, the descendants of Israel, which already had begun their migration, not yet in Europe, but probably around, as Peter and James both show, probably somewhere around the Caspian, the southern borders of the Caspian or the Black Sea. That's where Israel was at that time before migrating to Western Europe. That's where they went. That's where they went back. very likely. That's speculation on my part, so I'll label that as speculative, and others as well. He sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men, but they had deceived him. He was wrong. The Christ child escaped, but it was the satanic efforts that caused all of this to happen, so that even in infancy, the devil was trying to strike Jesus Christ down. And so we read in verse 18, this prophecy being fulfilled by Jeremiah, a voice heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, great mourning. Rachel, weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. One of the wives of Jacob was Rachel, weeping for her children as a mother could only do. Prophetically speaking, this individual who was the mother of many of the people of Israel's descendants crying out over this slaughter. And so God does not allow, as we know, does not allow the devil to do what God will not allow him to do. And this chapter shows, even as the young folks in the video showed, yes, this world is deceived. This world is broadcast. It receives the broadcast of the devil. He's the prince of the power of the air, as the young lady said, and that's accurate. But we haven't seen anything yet. God has put limitations on that particular power. This chapter describes a time when the gloves are coming off, and we haven't gotten there yet. In other words, well, I'll say that till we get to that verse. Verse 4 of Revelation 12. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. That didn't happen. She bore a male child who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and he will. And her child was caught up to God in his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days, 3.5 years. Many hundreds of years after the time of Joseph, the Jews, the descendants of the tribe of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi, all kind of lumped in together as one group, and a few remnants of the other tribes were the only descendants of ancient Israel that remained in Palestine. At the time of Christ's birth, it was the mighty Roman Empire that dominated them when Jesus was born. So the Messiah, to be born in the Jewish nation and to fulfill the prophecy, or actually the historical reference here, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God in his throne. What happened immediately after Christ's birth was Satan with his devices ready to attack. But because God is, of course, smarter and more capable than the devil, prevented that from happening. But again, Satan is going to relentlessly pursue and eventually kill some of God's people at the time of the end. Verse 7 of Revelation 12, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So that great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I suspect that this is when we will see the prophecies of Revelation 13 quickly come to pass, when that happens. Now, we can't be certain on timing, but 3.5 years of a great tribulation, and this chapter 12 shows that there will be some who will be protected, but that shouldn't be your object. That shouldn't be the deciding force in your life, that you're going to do something in order to be saved or to go to a place of safety or however that works out. And maybe there are a lot of things about that we just don't understand totally, or maybe we do understand them, and yet it sounds so fantastic that it seems unreal. That's not the object of your life. Before we finish, I'll try to close with, I think, what ought to be the object of some of our lives, at least one of those things that we ought to do and remember. But let's finish up here for a little bit. Verse 10, then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God night, day and night has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to the death. You know, that includes martyrdom, unfortunately. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath because he knows that he has a short time. And he will use the powers available to him to marshal up these forces, which will include the resurrection of a mighty empire brought back to life. He will breathe that life into that beast and its image, and they will rule the world for a short space of time. We already know that. Verse 13, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. Woman is symbolic of church. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time, times, and half a time from the presence of the serpent. Now, he won't be the manifestation of the devil appearing that will cause the persecution. It will be what is mentioned in the next chapter, the governmental properties that will be in extent at that time that are going to be doing the persecuting. They've always done it. They did it in the Middle Ages. They had persecutions. They were used in that sense. But as I said, we haven't really seen anything yet like that on the world scene. Verse 15, so the serpent spewed water out of his mouth like a flood. Some feel that flood refers to governments. I don't know. That he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the food which the dragon flood, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God, and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now, however that works out, in one sense, is really not your concern, in my opinion, at that time, because you'd like to be in the one category of being protected rather than having Satan coming after you and being martyred. Am I right? Any volunteers for martyrdom today? We won't start it or anything, but and nobody's going to put their hand up on this one. But this church is made up of individuals, and they occupy a very special place in prophecy. If you want other details, you can look in Revelation 6 and 7. But they do have the testimony of Jesus Christ, which is the revelation of prophecy as explained in this book, and twice in chapter 1, once in chapter 19. They keep the commandments of God. They have the testimony or the revelation of Jesus Christ, which was given to John by an angel. So when Satan loses his battle with God's angels, he directs his fury at the people of God, symbolically represented by the woman mentioned in earlier verses, and also the national aspect of the Israel of God. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16, just a very short sentence in that verse, and I'm taking it completely out of context, but you know what it says. Not that I'm being wrong in taking it out of context, because I'm just simply reading what this verse says about the people of God. And as many as walk according to this rule, peace and be mercy upon them and upon the Israel of God. Those are the spiritual descendants of Jacob, or Israel, as it were. Those are the people that are called by God. Galatians 4 and verse 26, just a few chapters back, says, but the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. It's the mother of us all. The church is the mother of us all. In this passage of Ephesians chapter 5, we know it, we use it many times. I'll ask you to turn to Matthew 5 and verse 22, or pardon me, Ephesians Ephesians 5:22, and it's a beautiful picture. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. There is the physical, spiritual analogy given here as well, as we know, about the marriage relationship. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, and he is Savior of the body. If Christ is the head of the church, and the church of God is going to be attacked by Satan the devil, I think that Jesus Christ is going to be looking out for his people, whether he allows something to happen or not. We just have to remember who the head of the church is, and he's the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word. The greatest power in refuting the devil is this fact, which is explained in Revelation 12 as being covered by the blood of the Lamb. And it's the same thing, the washing of the water by the word, the covering of Christ's blood, it all goes together. That he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. And that is why the accusations of Satan are not going to stick, because there is such a thing as Christ, our Passover lamb, is sacrificed for us, and there is such a thing as forgiveness. And we should remember that about every single person that is in the church of God. Verse 30, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Verse 32, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ in the church. Again, analogies break down after a while, but they serve a purpose in helping us understand our roles and responsibilities. Interestingly enough, no coincidence in my opinion, in the next chapter, it begins after speaking about family, marriage, husbands, wives, it speaks about the first commandment with promise. That to me is very interesting. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise. Years ago, when I was in Ambassador College, a very devoted minister told us in our advanced public speaking class, and many of us respected this individual, I won't reveal his name, but he told us in class one day that every Mother's Day, he sent the church a Mother's Day card. Yeah, that sounded strange to you, too. It sounded strange to us when we heard it. We were too intimidated to ask him, okay, how did you do that? Did you send it to 300 West Green Street, Pasadena, California, 91109? P.O. Box 111, Pasadena, California, 91102? How did that happen? Did you send it to Mr. Armstrong? I mean, it was mind-boggling to us. We couldn't understand what he was getting at. We had a hard time figuring out exactly how he did that. And I don't know if he actually did it or if he just used it in some kind of mysterious way to get a point across in a lecture, that the scripture also says that the church is the mother of us all. It's the mother of us all. I think the meaning that he had was that the church was and should be a safe and secure environment for its members. And to be honest, I began to feel that sense of comfort in reading Mr. Armstrong's book, The Book of Revelation Unveiled at Last, because even as a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old at that point, I began to see in my limited understanding that there was something that helped explain my place in life. Why were you born? How many people know that? I began to see with that inspiration that there was something that God had in store for me. I didn't really have any clue as to what it was. And as I was reading some of the other booklets, 1975 in Prophecy, and seeing bodies by the multiple millions being bulldozed into cavernous pits, you know, to be buried under the Great Tribulation, I thought I'd better start doing something about my life. But I began to feel that there was something out there that helped explain the world that we lived in, explained the purpose of life, and helped us to understand it. And second, I felt the comfort of the church as a mother, and then felt that when I began to attend services. Was the church perfect then? Are you kidding me? 1971, the church was not perfect by any means, and it never will be, except in Revelation 12, where it shows that all of her offspring are covered by that blood and comforted by the love of Jesus Christ. I believe that this was this minister's way of expressing his appreciation for all the church had done for him in a very special way. Now, our American tradition of celebrating Mother's Day began soon after the end of the Civil War. And I'm going to tell you how well I know this congregation. I think there are probably one or two people that might recognize this name. Let's see if I'm correct. Julia Ward Howe. Anybody in here who might know who she is? Exactly. I knew who would remember that name, although when I first read it, I said, oh, yeah, she did this. She wrote the very inspirational hymn, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Julia Ward Howe went on a crusade in 1870 because she was so touched by the many deaths of sons during the Civil War, and she had written the Battle Hymn of the Republic in 1858. But she was so touched and moved and horrified by the horrors of war, and that was probably one of our most horrifying war as a nation, brothers killing brothers. And she recognized this, that this was wrong. And she tried to get women mobilized to protest ever again that kind of wanton, senseless killing where a mother would be left without her son. It was very noble and very dignified, and it kind of waxed and waned through the years. And Mother's Day tradition and being kept in this country began then and had, you know, a little impact, but only until 1908, when a woman named Anna Jarvis was able to, after a considerable period of time, petitioned her superintendent at her Methodist church to institute a day to honor her mother, who had taught Bible class at that Sunday school for over 20 years, and she was apparently, in her daughter's eyes, a very wonderful, beautiful, the epitome of what motherhood should be. And from there, eventually, Mother's Day became a quasi-national holiday, over-commercialized like most things are. But still, the thought of recognizing your mother and, you know, the kind of thought of sending a card to your church, the mother of us all, sounds a little bit hokey, but you understand the sentiment. Now, have you ever recognized this, that it is almost impossible to pick out a bad Mother's Day card? Or actually, any kind of greeting card. You almost go into a greeting card store or Albertsons or Walmart or wherever you buy cards, you can basically close your eyes and throw a dart, pick out something nice. Not how I do it. If it's lavender, you know, it's got nice cursive writing on it, you can bet the message inside is going to be pretty nice. It doesn't have to do just with Mother's Day, but it's probably true with a lot of different cards. Is it possible, in getting back to what we read in Ephesians, is it possible to disrespect your mother and still honor the first commandment with promise? I lost my mother a few years ago, And we didn't always see eye to eye on things. She was a very talented and gifted individual, very artistic. She both artistic musically, both in music and also in general artistry. She was a great artist. She painted oil paintings. We've retained a few of them in our home. But she was a wonderful person overall. And I would have to say that it'd be very difficult for anyone to disrespect their mother and still honor them at the same time. I mean, now maybe it's tough. I'm not talking about the weird situations where, you know, you've got these outlying problems, problematic parents. We're not talking about that. But what about your mother, the church? Is it possible to dishonor the church? I think from time to time we should all ask ourselves that question. Revelation 12 shows that God promises this favored woman a place where she's nourished for a time, times, and half a time. And the other aspect of those individuals shows that they keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. In this negative world that we live in, it's often very easy to find fault and criticize and see problems. But notice that Satan is going to rage against individuals that keep commandments and follow the actual teachings of Jesus Christ. The birth of this church is shown in Revelation 12, and it's also shown in the Bible that this is the mother of us all. Now, what is that church? It's not a church building in Cincinnati, Ohio, or Pasadena, California. It's the people of the church. Is it possible to disrespect your fellow Christians and still love your mother? I think the answer is obvious. Let's give honor to all that that means to us, the Church of God.